Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. There's a great scene in the movie The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman. A well-meaning family friend gives young Benjamin Braddock some advice at his graduation party.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics.
I mean, he was not wrong. Plastic exploded into most aspects of manufacturing in the decades following World War II, a magic shapeshifter that could be turned into all kinds of consumer goods.
Sheets of plastic, for example, can be shaped quickly into hats that look like traditional straws. After heat is applied to a synthetic called Dynel,
plastic took the world by storm, and now it's present in every part of our lives.
So I'm sitting in my room looking around things that are made of plastic. Okay.
A plastic cup.
Drinking mug.
My keyboard, which is made of plastic.
Computer keyboard.
Computer.
My laptop.
Electric mixer.
My fax machine.
Mechanical pencil.
Plastic.
Lipstick tube.
Pill bottles, nasal spray, perfume.
My lights.
Some cat toys.
A lot of my toiletries.
I'm riding home from work right now. There's trash bags everywhere.
Plastic laundry baskets.
Some markers.
And my bookcase.
Plastic, plastic everywhere.
Okay, traffic light.
Those brakes are plastic. They don't sound so good.
In the U.S., much of the plastic we use piles up in landfills. Even though you may put it in your recycling bin, it doesn't get recycled. It makes its way into waterways and oceans. Plastic bottles, shredded bags, balls, tires floating around, and small plastic particles end up even in the guts of fish, crabs, or seabirds.
And when we dissected them, they were full of plastic. The little pre-production pellets, bits of plastic, bric-a-brac, Coca-Cola bottle rings.
In recent decades, plastic has become a rallying call for people who care about the environment. Communities are trying to ban single-use plastic items like bags or bottles. But given how versatile, cheap, and ubiquitous plastic is, things get complicated quickly. On today's episode, the miracle and menace of plastic. There are lots of different types of plastic, but they all have one thing in common. They are a long polymer.
Plastics are basically any kind of long molecule. I always think of them like spaghetti or hair.
That's chemist and polymer scientist Chris DeArmitt. He says there are many ways to make plastic, for example, through a process called radical polymerization.
So that's when you take one small molecule, think of it like a paperclip, and you add a catalyst, and the paperclip attaches to the next paperclip, and that attaches to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and it grows like that, one step at a time. And within even seconds, you can have a polymer, which is a chain, which is thousands of units long, and that's your polymer.
We use fossil fuels to make most of our plastic, so that's one concern. It's not a renewable source. Add to that the trash issues, and we find ourselves in a desperate quest to replace or even ban plastic, especially single-use plastics. But Chris says, be careful what you think of as green.
So this is what's driving me nuts. I don't care if people are against plastic, but what drives me nuts is that people who really care about the environment are making terrible decisions because they've been lied to.
Like, we're deluding ourselves. We think we're replacing that evil plastic bag or bottle with something much better. But it's not that simple. Chris says to really understand the environmental impact, you have to look at a life cycle analysis.
Which means what's actually good for the environment in terms of water and energy and pollution and CO2 in the atmosphere.
How much energy it takes to produce something like a paper bag.
So if we go to a paper bag, you need to cut down millions more trees, you have more pollution, you use more energy.
And how much energy it takes to recycle a product, glass, for example.
you know, you don't have to do complex science to understand why. If you melt glass, it's glowing red hot, right? It's like lava. It's at thousands of degrees. That's the energy needed to melt glass. And I'm like, are you crazy? Who wants to be melting glass again and again and again at thousands of degrees, killing the environment, whereas you melt plastic at a couple hundred degrees, not a couple thousand. There's nothing glowing red hot. It's a much lower energy process, which means less coal burns or oil burns at the power station.
Plastic, or spend your paper on plastic, or buy a light that's fantastic, cause all you are is your assets.
So replacing one material with another one is not necessarily a solution. Another idea is to produce greener types of plastic, not made from fossil fuels and easier to compost. These are called biopolymers, plastic made from renewable natural resources like plants, mushrooms, or even waste methane. That sounds great, right? So what's holding up the triumph of green plastic? Alan Yu takes us on a tour of three companies that are making these biopolymers right now.
Let's start with the leading candidate, polylactic acid, or PLA. A company called NatureWorks has the world's largest PLA factory in Nebraska. I spoke to Leah Ford. She's in charge of marketing at NatureWorks.
We use plants to turn greenhouse gases into the raw materials that are used for products we all use every day. That's the big crazy idea.
You take corn grown in huge fields in Nebraska, ferment it a little like how you ferment beer, and make lactic acid. Then you combine a long string of those to make polylactic acid, the plastic in this case. You can turn that into a steady stream of small white plastic pellets. From there, you can treat it like any other plastic. Melt it down, put it in a mold, leave it to cool, and you can churn out basically any plastic product you care to mold, like, say, coffee pots from a giant press.
We have developed a lot of the initial processes for how do you make a form, fill, and seal yogurt container? How do you make foam for a meat tray? What's the best way to make a compostable coffee capsule or a better spunbond non-woven for a face mask?
They sell a lot of their product to people who use 3D printers.
Most desktop-style printers ship with our material by default.
NatureWorks started as a research project at the giant food company Cargill in 1989. It took them years to refine the process, figure out what they can make with PLA, and manufacture at scale. And the resulting product is something that can break down in compost. If you've seen compostable utensils or plates from takeout places, that could be made from PLA.
Where I live in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, I have a third bin where I can put all of my compostable packaging, all of my organics, all of my food waste, and have it be collected right alongside my trash and recycling.
Not every place is like St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Municipal composting is growing, but still not universal. It takes effort to teach people to separate what they can and cannot compost. And if you have a compost pile in your backyard, you cannot put compostable plastic there. You need industrial composting on some kind of city-wide scale, because only those are hot enough to break down the plastic. Then there is the question of where the raw materials for PLA comes from.
So a lot of people think that biopolymers means things that come from completely natural sources, so there's a nice low carbon footprint, and that at end of life, they'll just disintegrate into something completely harmless.
That's Claire Barlow, a senior lecturer of engineering at Cambridge University and an expert on sustainable materials.
The agriculture, which is used to provide the source material for biopolymers, is industrial scale. And this is actually not green at all.
Growing vast quantities of corn requires energy, water, fertilizer, and sometimes pesticides. You can make PLA from other plants, but you still have to grow them. Now, of course, Leah and NatureWorks have thought about these problems. She says if you compare two cups, one made from PLA and one made from polystyrene, the foam plastic that fast food places used to use for coffee cups, making the PLA cup uses less energy. And Leah brings up the fair point of whether we ask those same questions of petrochemicals. But the questions remain: how big is the environmental impact of making the PLA? And are we composting on a large enough scale to take care of the waste problem? You can, of course, get around the first problem by making biopolymer out of other raw materials. Which brings us to our second candidate: plastic that comes from literal human waste.
You know, you would think that the smell would be worse, but it's actually not that bad here. Perhaps I'm just used to it.
Over a video call, I'm looking at a huge concrete cylinder in Redwood City, California, that collects food waste and whatever it is the 200,000 people over there flush down their toilets. My virtual guide is Joe Lampe. He's a fermentation specialist at Mango Materials.
So we are at a wastewater treatment facility. You know, there's a lot of construction going on, so got to wear this hard hat here and the safety vest.
Mango Materials is a company that takes the methane gas from the waste and feeds it to bacteria. Normally, facilities like this burn the methane to produce electricity.
In the morning, it's very beautiful. You know, it's a large flame erupting from the top of the building.
It's a waste product. A strong greenhouse gas if released, so you might as well get some power out of it. But there are bacteria that actually feed on methane to make another biopolymer called PHA. Molly Morse is the CEO of Mango Materials, and the company is based on work she did for her PhD with a co-founder. She got started based on kind of an offhand comment her advisor made.
The pathway to make PHAs, it's very ubiquitous in nature. There's many, many living things that make PHAs. Historically, the way we've made them is by taking sugar and feeding sugar to bacteria that produce PHA. And he said, you know, hey, instead of doing that, what if we took methane and we fed the methane to bacteria to produce PHA?
And there is no shortage of raw material.
There's methane everywhere. It's essentially wherever there's people or there's living things, there tends to be methane. Most of the methane producers that we talk to, whether we approach them or often they approach us, you know, maybe they're using methane to make electricity or something else, but they're generally hungry for something else to use their methane for.
Using this gas to make plastic makes more money than burning it for electricity or heat. Mango Materials even got funding from NASA to see if their process can work in space. And their product can also break down in compost. So unlike with PLA, the plastic made from corn, you don't have a problem with manufacturing because it's made from stuff we produce and send down the drain anyway. The problem here is scale. We like plastic because of its chemical properties, but also because it is cheap. Mango Materials needs to make a lot of their PHA biopolymers and drive down the cost if they want people to buy it. But they need to have a lot of customers to sell to if they want to make more, so it's a bit of a dilemma. They are not at that scale right now.
We need to be above 100 million pounds.
Right now, they are making less than 1 million pounds a year.
It works right now because we get a premium for these specific applications we're working on, but we're still a little ways from break even.
So that's the story on plastic made from methane. But we have a third candidate, plastic that comes from mushrooms. The company Ecovative uses fungi and agricultural waste to grow mycelium, the root-like structure of a mushroom, which you can turn into a styrofoam-like material. They actually have achieved some scale, with partner companies in California, the UK, the Netherlands, and New Zealand. One of the founders is Gavin McIntyre.
Think of it as a sandcastle. We take a mixture of particles, the agricultural debris and mycelium, pour them into an enclosure, and then the mycelium binds the particles together to result in that final shape or geometry.
Their partner companies use the mushroom plastic to make everything from packaging for cosmetics to lampshades and tables. And the stuff does not smell like mushrooms.
It really smells more or less like the wood that you would find in a lumber yard. more than a mushroom that you'd find in a grocery store.
So this product has a lot going for it. It's made from a waste product. They have the manufacturing process down. But even this company, with partners in several countries, is still working on making and selling enough of the mushroom plastic so that it is profitable everywhere and as cheap as regular plastic. Otherwise, it'll be a good way for companies to promote themselves as environmentally friendly, but then consumers like us would have to pay more for those products. This could change with time. Leah Ford from NatureWorks, the PLA manufacturer we heard from first, points out that plastic from fossil fuels had a significant head start.
Our plant in Nebraska was the first of its kind. You know, the traditional or petrochemical-based plastics have, you know, 60 years of efficiency in building plants and running these materials. It's easy for them to scale up and down. And we are still learning how to make these products better, faster, and keep it all economically feasible. And we also want to do it responsibly. These are products that are based on renewable resources. We don't want to scale these industries and create more environmental problems in the long run.
That's an important point, because even if all of our plastics started to be made from green sources tomorrow, it would still not solve all the environmental problems we have with plastic in the first place.
It's not a question of technology.
That's Ramani Narayan, a chemical engineer and materials scientist at Michigan State University who specializes in biodegradable polymers. He says we can already recycle fossil fuel-based plastic. We don't even have to compost it. But right now, making new plastic is just cheaper. Companies and governments can say they want to be environmentally friendly, but they'd have to back that up by paying for it.
You're extracting oil, no environmental considerations or little environmental consideration. And therefore, if the brand owners are saying, I want it at the same price as existing, then it's never going to happen. Then they're just giving lip service to it. Everybody is looking for a free lunch.
He said that if you want to solve the waste problem, we don't even necessarily need to invent new plastics. What we have to do is make it expensive and undesirable to pollute the environment. But that would require governments, businesses, changing their habits on some large scale, which is maybe harder to do than inventing a whole new material.
That was Alan Yu reporting, and the last expert he talked to just made a point about how a lot of this issue comes down to rethinking consumption. There's no magical way to erase all of our trash problems. We have to change behavior on an industry level, but also among individual consumers. Polymer scientist Chris DeArmid gave me an example of that, a plastic straw.
Don't take a straw. I can't believe the amount of times people are arguing about what's the greenest straw. If you do the life cycle analysis, a plastic straw is proven to be greener than a paper straw or a metal straw or any other crazy material. But why not just don't take a straw? Our whole society is just so obsessed by waste and single use and throwing things out. And another example is my daughter used a plastic straw for 3 months in a row, right? She used it for 100 days in a row. We put it through the dishwasher and it was fine. So just use it again. You don't have to go and buy a metal straw that takes 1,000 times more energy to create.
Chris DeArmid is the president of Phantom Plastics and the author of The Plastics Paradox. It's easy to see plastic and feel down about it, think it's cheap or bad. And in that, we tend to forget how much plastic changed every aspect of our modern lives. Peter Crimmins has this look at plastic and design.
I'm here at home in my kitchen, and I want to show you something. I have here a vintage mid-century casserole dish. It's made of iron, and it's coated with enamel. This, back in the day, is what people both cooked food in and stored food in. It has a lid that sort of fits loosely like this. It's not airtight. It's really heavy. It's not something you would want to schlep around to a potluck and put that away. Now, this here is a plastic storage tub. Drop the lid there, and you know what this sounds like. Here you go. It's airtight. It doesn't leak. The food won't dry out in the refrigerator, and if you drop it, It's not going to crack like enamel or not going to shatter like glass. It's also really colorful. This one is a deep red, but you can just get them in any color you want. When plastic entered the home in a big way after World War II, it introduced all new options in both function and style.
It was really novel.
That's Sarah Archer. She's a design historian and the author of The Mid-Century Kitchen.
For years and years and years, kitchens really had been either kind of wood and cast iron, kind of going way back in the 19th century, or in the 19-teens and 20s, kind of sterile, like an old-fashioned doctor's office, kind of white enamel on black metal. The idea of being able to introduce sort of a fashion color, like pink or turquoise, was thrilling. It was sort of the beginning of understanding the kitchen as a place where you can entertain, and having that room in a fun color was part of the changing landscape of the home itself.
Now let's go to a little town in New Jersey where things are really popping. Yes, there's a party going on at Mrs. Betty Martin's house. It's a Tupperware party, and it's really fun.
Tupperware was created by a guy named Earl Tupper. He was a chemical engineer with DuPont, and he was looking on how to repurpose polyethylene slag. That's a waste product from oil refineries, and he figured out it could be made into flexible plastic that burps.
At one side. Hear that? That's Tupperware's airtight promise to lock in flavor and lock out air.
Tupper left DuPont and started his own company in 1948 to make Tupperware, and he turned to a marketer from Florida named Brownie Wise, who had a novel way to sell it.
They started planning Tupperware parties. Plastic, as you know, all of us know when we open a new shower curtain liner or get into a new car, plastic has a smell. And for people in the 1940s and 50s, it was totally alien. Nobody knew what this was. Tupperware parties were a place for people to see the products demoed, see all the sort of fashion colors that were available, the pinks and turquoises, and kind of smell it and see that it was, air quotes, safe, as of course we know now that plastic is not exactly without risk or without consequence, but at the time it was kind of a way for people to get used to the material and just have it become part of life.
While Tupperware and similar plastic products were aggressively marketed to women in the home, plastic also sold itself. It was modern, it was novel, it was colorful, and it seemed to be just magical. People even wrote love songs to plastic. Cole Porter had a hit in 1934 called You're the Top. It compares a paramour to a list of really wonderful things. The Tower of Pisa, the Mona Lisa, you're the purple light of a summer night in Spain, you're cellophane.
Purple light of a summer night in Spain. You're the National Gallery, you're Garbo Sally, you're cellophane.
In the 1950s, plastic also entered the home through toys. Consider Hasbro, a toy company founded in 1923 just outside Providence, Rhode Island, by the brothers Halal and Henry Hassenfeld.
Hey, it's Hasbro. Hasbro makes toys.
The brothers' first big hit came in the 1950s with Mr. Potato Head.
See, Mr. Potato Head has a car and boat trailer.
The original Mr. Potato Head was literally a potato. The kit was sold as a set of plastic parts that your kids would stick into an actual tuber.
Take any fruit or vegetable. Just stick in eyes, then ears, and then the mouth.
They soon realized that the actual potato part was maybe not so smart because the potato would get lost under a couch and rot. So then they went to all plastic.
That is Wayne Miller. He's a journalist in Providence who has written two books about Hasbro. In the 1960s, the company developed a green polymer blob that kids could squish between their fingers. They called it Flubber, a tie-in to a popular movie at the time called The Absent-Minded Professor. It starred Fred McMurray.
I'm not sure what we've got here, Charlie. But if we've got what I think we've got, we've got...
Kids started playing with it and began breaking out with all body rashes. There was something in that material that caused a toxic reaction. And so they had to recall it all, and it nearly sank the company, literally. It was such a horrible mistake that they had made.
Hasbro yanked Flubber off the shelves in 1963, but had a hard time getting rid of it. They tried to bury it and burn it, but no municipality would let them do it on their property. They tried to sink it in a lake, but Flubber floats. Ultimately, Hasbro dug a deep hole on its own property in Rhode Island, dumped the Flubber into it, and paved it over as a parking lot. Hasbro no longer fabricates plastic toys in Rhode Island. That's all been moved overseas. But it still prototypes toys there and continues to be a big economic engine in that area. The Hasbro factory influenced artist Jonathan Santoro. He grew up near the plant in the suburbs of Providence, when they were still churning out plastic toys in the 1980s. Jonathan makes installation art. He creates objects out of plastic and installs them as a tableau that tells some kind of story.
Think about these kind of staging toy sets. This kind of play, I feel like, is like something I've learned as a child.
Jonathan has mixed feelings about plastic.
And I guess I'm trying to like negotiate my feelings where something so mass-produced can elicit personal joy.
On the one hand, plastic is a byproduct of mass consumerism, and on the other hand, plastic makes its pieces so alluring.
They kind of take you in with the sheen or the color, and there's kind of a siren's call to it. My work often gets damaged because people, they want to touch it.
Jonathan's work speaks to our love-hate relationship with plastic. These days, many people have an aversion to plastic. There's a long list of reasons plastic consumer products might be problematic, but they are myriad design options, colors, forms, and functions that we have come to associate with quality of life, with convenience and newness. Think about the feeling of sitting in a brand new car and the smell of it. There are air fresheners you can buy with that new car smell to bring you back to that feeling of being in something fresh and new. What is it that we're smelling?
It's the plasticizer or the softener that's in the plastic.
Ron Kander is a polymer scientist and dean of the Kanbar College of Design at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia.
Your dashboard is made out of vinyl. It's brittle. The reason your dashboard feels like leather is small molecules that are put into the plastic to soften it. That new car smell is the plasticizers evaporating out of the plastic.
Americans were taught to like that smell of plastic at the first Tupperware party in 1949, and now, for better or worse, we still think plastic is fantastic.
That was Peter Crimmins reporting, and when he talked to engineer Ron Kander, Ron asked Peter a question.
What do you think the largest application of polymers that generates the largest volume of landfill in the world is?
I don't know. I want to say water bottles, but I don't know. Yeah.
Clothing.
Oh, really? Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, clothing, fast fashion.
In many ways, plastic fabrics have come to be associated with being problematic and also kind of gaudy, like that shrill pilling sweater that you put on and you start sweating immediately. But the connection between plastic and fashion started as a glamorous love affair.
Gateway to the $155 million Wonderland.
At the New York World's Fair and at the Golden Gate International Exposition in 1939, where nylon made its debut.
So people came there, they wanted to see nylon, and they particularly wanted to see nylon as modeled on the live model that DuPont then had in their show, who actually stepped out of a test tube at one point as part of the display, totally dressed in plastics.
Wow, what did the model wear?
So she was wearing nylon stockings, she had on lucite heels, she had a dress made of rayon and a cellophane hat, I believe. So she was totally dressed in these really exciting new materials.
That's Isabel Marina Held. She researches the history of plastics and their role in shaping the human body. She's a fellow at the Science History Institute in Philadelphia.
There was a real kind of desire to touch the material. But unfortunately, DuPont wasn't producing enough of it at the time, so they really didn't want to have it out in the open for lots of people to be touching because they were worried that they didn't have enough available. And so they actually had a set of mechanical hands stretching a nylon stocking back and forth behind a kind of, you know, like a curtain. You couldn't access that. And they were hoping that that would kind of get across the materiality. But people's instincts was they just wanted to touch it. They wanted to really physically, bodily engage with the material. You know, imagine things like static that we're really used to now. That was a really new kind of sensation for many people, and they wanted to find out more about these things.
So plastic was quickly used as a way to literally shape a woman's body, to like push and pull and bring out certain things and tuck in others, right?
Yeah, so plastic foams. Previously, before World War II, foams were already being used in things like the bra, for example, but these were foam rubbers. It was very brittle. It didn't deal well with things like perspiration and things like that. And it's only after World War II where we see a lot of synthetic rubbers come onto the market that these new plastic foams seem to offer new kind of ways of sponginess and softness that are longer lasting through things like padding in foundation wear, girdles, butt pads, hip pads to kind of achieve the hourglass new look figure.
Isabel says a lot of the materials that came out of this post-war period are still widely used today and more accessible than ever.
Particularly interesting is that it's important to also note that it's not just cis women who were shaping their bodies with kind of plastic foams and bullet bras and things like this. It's also trans women are and were also shaping their bodies with those materials, and that these are available in a wide range of skin tones. And just the other day, I was in a drugstore here in Philadelphia, and there was a whole wall of like silicone pads that you can put in your bra or you can use to cover up your nipples as kind of an essential product in the drugstore. And I think it's really great that they're available now in so many different skin tones.
And how have these fabrics evolved over time? So if I look at Spanx today, I'm sure it's very different from those first generations of shapewear that were available in terms of the material too. So has there been a lot of science making this stuff more effective?
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting to think about Spanx actually, because Lycra was created by DuPont.
Lycra is a very lightweight, stretchy material.
I think one of the main things that they wanted was to create a material that has really high elasticity but doesn't necessarily lose its shape. You know, that could be stretched so far and then it would sort of jump right back into shape. That's quite amazing, really, if you think about it, in terms of Lycra is such an amazing material, the way it really hugs your body in and is so strong but also so soft. They spent a lot of time creating that material. But by the time DuPont actually finally were ready with Lycra, the times had changed. So it took them over 10 years. And by the time they were ready to launch the product on the market, it was the 1960s. And many women, especially younger women, really weren't interested in having a kind of almost restrictive garment, I guess, to hold them in. And then Lycra gets used, of course, for kind of sportswear and aerobics and things like that. But what's quite interesting is that Spanx, I was looking at their products, and a lot of them kind of are offering now, I think, what many of the DuPont staff were hoping potentially to achieve then.
Isabel Marina Held is a postdoctoral fellow at the Science History Institute in Philadelphia. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Subscribe to our podcast and never miss an episode. Coming up, ever heard of plastivores?
Individual organisms that use plastic as their primary carbon and energy source, so they can live off of nothing but plastic, which is pretty wild to think about.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable, quality health care for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
We're talking about plastic. how it changed our lives, and how we're dealing with the fallout. The idea that plastic will be recycled makes us feel better about our consumption.
The recycling makes you feel good. It's a reward to you. It does it for you, doesn't it?
But truth is, most of our plastic in the U.S. is not recycled for a variety of reasons. Recent investigative reporting from NPR and Frontline found that the plastic industry promoted recycling for decades, while industry insiders expressed doubts that plastic recycling would ever become viable. But from a technical standpoint, it's not that difficult to do. I talked about that with polymer scientist Chris DeArmid.
It's very, very easy to recycle plastic, and you can prove it to yourself, right? Take a piece of Tupperware, the original Tupperware made of polypropylene, and heat it up, right? It melts. You can change it from that form into another form. And that's how most plastic is recycled. You simply melt it and make a new shape out of it and use it again. And that can be done many times, 10 or 20 times for some plastics. You could literally use it for some years, melt it into a new shape, use it for some more years, and carry on like that.
But does it have to be sorted very carefully? Because I'm thinking, like, if I'm melting my Tupperware container and my water bottle, those are two different kinds of plastics.
Yeah, that's a terrific point. So if you take plastics and you don't sort them, you end up with something that has worse properties than if you do sort them. So you can still recycle a mess, right? You could take a mess of four or five different plastics, melt it together, and you'll still get something like a park bench or something you could use for wood, you know, like a wood decking type of application. But it won't be as good as it will be if you sort them and meticulously separate them. So one of the reasons that people are driving to use a few standard plastics now, wherever possible, is exactly that, right? So the car industry likes to make everything they can out of polypropylene. So at the end of life of the car, you take it, you throw it all together, and it all melts together nicely.
In the U.S., though, recycling plastic is in many cases just not cost effective. It's cheaper to make new plastic. So that means we have to either drastically reduce our consumption or find new ways of breaking it down once it hits the trash. Some scientists are looking for new ways to do just that. Liz Tung has more.
In 2016, Erica Erickson was a brand new biochemist, fresh off her PhD in plant biology, when she decided to spend a year volunteering with the Peace Corps. They sent her to a small village in the West African country of Guinea. Picture mud huts with thatched roofs, surrounded by unspoiled, stunning nature.
Yeah, it was absolutely gorgeous. There's very little development. And so for anyone who's an outdoor enthusiast, it was kind of a magical place.
But Erica's job wasn't to marvel at the beauty around her. She was there to think about resilient systems, which brings us to trash.
And one of my big projects there was looking at how to keep waste from ending up in all of the streams that everyone uses as their drinking water and in all of the fields.
Guinea is one of the poorest countries in the world, which means that in a lot of places, there is zero waste management. Instead, people simply dump their trash by the roadside, a major portion of which is plastic.
So in cities along the coast, it's really not uncommon to find that the dishes are full of trash. And then after a big rainstorm, that's all floated down and is covering the beach.
Further inland, plastic waste meets a different fate. When the piles get too high, people simply burn them.
I mean, the smell is horrendous, and it's also kind of unmitigated fires that are kind of burning all the time in road ditches. But more than that, having plastic in the area that I lived in was huge. It was life-changing for the people that live there.
Life-changing because traditionally, every single item they used had to be made from scratch.
Things are constructed and made by hand or from natural resources in the area.
So when Erica said plastic had changed people's lives, I thought she meant in a bad way, that it had ruined their traditions and trashed their natural spaces. But that's not at all what she told me. In fact, she says plastic made life a lot easier, a lot better overall for people in the village.
So you could get clean water. Things that had been exorbitantly expensive supplies to get before were available at a price that people could afford. And so it was a really necessary thing, I think, for development and for bringing people's standards of living up to a place where there's less illness and a lot more comfort. But there's no real good way to deal with the aftermath of that. And so that's what I saw while I was there.
For Erica, this framed the central dilemma of plastic. As much as we might want to reduce our use, we are heavily dependent on plastic. And what's at stake isn't just straws and extra grocery bags. In some cases, it's the lives and health of people around the world. It's a big part of what pushed Erica into the work she does now at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, figuring out a way we can decrease the environmental harm of plastic rather than getting rid of it altogether. And not only that, but hopefully using the plastic that already exists to generate new renewable products. Plastic, remember, is made primarily from something we already use to make nearly every synthetic material you can think of: fossil fuels.
Plastic is highly abundant, pretty dispersed across the planet, and has a lot of really good energetic bonds in it that we can use for new products and energy that way.
Erica's lab works with a bigger group called the Bottle Consortium. They're trying to figure out a way of unlocking that stored energy, while at the same time tackling the growing problem of plastic pollution. One of the worst offenders when it comes to plastic pollution is PET, or polyethylene terephthalate. It's easier to recycle than a lot of other plastics, but there's also a ton of it out there. Here is one of Erica's colleagues, another researcher at the lab named Brandon Knott.
Erica said that this is used in a lot of single-use plastics, like your soda bottles, your water bottles, your takeout food containers. You know, they're sort of designed for a single use. They're really lightweight, so they're easier to escape out of, you know, where they should be. And they end up in the places where we don't want them, namely out in the environment.
Unless, of course, they get recycled, which can happen in one of two ways. The first is what's called mechanical recycling, which basically means the plastic gets crushed up, melted down, and then reused. The problem is, not only is the material to be recycled contaminated with dirt and other plastics which interfere with the chemistry, but also the material begins to degrade. And as a result, the recycled plastic is worse quality. It gets remade into lower-priced goods, like carpet or park benches, and eventually ends up in a landfill. As for the second big option, after mechanical recycling,
just burning the plastic. So a lot of places will take all of the waste, mostly plastic, and just burn it and use this as heat.
But what if there were a way to break plastic down to its constituent parts? Parts that would either not be harmful to the environment or could be reused to make new plastics. As it turns out, there is something that has that ability, but it's not some kind of solvent or chemical process. It's a life form called plastivores.
Individual organisms that use plastic as their primary carbon and energy source, so they can live off of nothing but plastic, which is pretty wild to think about.
In 2016, Japanese scientists discovered the first plastivores in the form of bacterium that was able to survive solely on PET bottles, which Erica says is kind of mind-blowing.
The reason I say that's kind of wild to think about is that PET was invented in the 1940s, I think early 1940s. So that's not very long for an organism to decide that that's a good, tasty meal.
The discovery kicked off an international race among scientists to identify the key to these bacteria's success, the enzymes, or proteins, that are responsible for breaking the plastic down. Since then, the research on plastivores has expanded in all directions, including the recent discovery of our very first animal plastivore, the humble waxworm. Canadian biologist Christophe Lemoyne says a European team made the discovery 3 or 4 years ago, entirely by accident.
Kind of the funny story behind that is that one of the team members is actually a beekeeper. And what happened is that she was just cleaning her hive and found some of those waxworms, put them in a plastic bag, wrap it up, put them on the kitchen counter, and a couple of hours later, the waxworms were happily sneaking their way out of the plastic bag. So that's kind of what put the waxworm on the international scene.
The big mission after that discovery was figuring out what the mystery enzyme or enzymes were that allowed the waxworms to break plastic down. Christophe, who'd been studying the effects of microplastics on animal physiology, teamed up with an insect biologist to find out how exactly waxworms were able to digest plastic. It was, in other words, a different version of the same mission other scientists have been on, zeroing in on the magic formula for breaking plastic down.
At first, our goal was to try to decipher whether or not it was the bacteria or the waxworm that was doing the stuff. So essentially trying to figure out if the bacteria was really mostly responsible for the plastic breakdown, the polyethylene breakdown, or if it was the worm.
So who gets the credit, the bacteria or the worm? In March of last year, Chris and his colleagues released a study with the beginnings of an answer. It showed that the waxworm's digestive microbes were the bigger factor in its ability to break down plastic.
But it also suggested that if you just take the microbes out of the guts, it's still not as efficient as together. So we are we're still pursuing that question, trying to figure out what is this synergy between the bacteria and the waxworm that allow them to really accelerate this breakdown of plastic.
The ultimate goal with all this research is to isolate the enzyme, the secret sauce, that's responsible for achieving that breakdown, improving it, and hopefully applying it on an industrial scale. Most of the scientists I talked to said we're still probably years away from making that a reality, except for one.
We are now building a demo plant, and it will be in operation in September 2021.
That's biochemical engineer Alain Marty. He's the chief science officer for a French company called Carbios. A few months ago, they announced that they'd synthesized an enzyme capable of breaking down PET 10,000 times faster than the bacterium discovered by the Japanese scientists. Here's how Alain described the painstaking process of improving that enzyme.
I am used to say that an enzyme and its substrate is like a lock and a key. In this case, the key is the PET and the lock is the enzymes. But the lock is not perfect to receive the PET. And then my job was, with my group, to improve the lock in order to have a better affinity of the enzyme for the substrate, in order to have a very, very efficient enzymes.
When they started in 2015, it took them several weeks to degrade just 2 or 3% of PET.
And nowadays, our best result is to be able to degrade 90% in 10 hours.
Not only that, they're able to break the plastic down to its constituent elements, pure enough to reform plastic of equal quality to the original. Len says Carbios already has investment from major companies like L'Oreal and Pepsi Coke. And their goal is to open recycling plants around the world, capable of handling 1 to 200,000 tons of plastic each year. Carbios may be the first, but other scientists aren't too far behind. Just a few months ago, the group Erica and Brandon are part of put out a study describing the second of two key enzymes capable of breaking PET down. For now, they're cautiously optimistic.
We should be really excited about the advances that are being made in terms of enzymes breaking down PET. But there are lots of different types of plastics, and we need solutions to recycle and upcycle all of them.
And maybe most importantly, we need to find ways of using less plastic altogether. At the same time, we have to remember that plastic isn't just wrappers and straws and junk that we don't need. It's also clean water and basins for doing the washing. In places like the village where Erica lived, it's health and resources and hours of manpower that would all need to be replaced.
Yeah, the social aspects of this are also really important, that we can come up with new technologies, but we can't necessarily create a technology to save ourselves. We kind of have to do that from the ground up.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and make sure you subscribe. But no one knows he really is a plastic man. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Our health equity fellow is Sojourner Ahebe. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Xavier Lopez is our associate producer, Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Drinking from my plastic bottle. I've been reusing this since I was 10 years old.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.